Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Today, we're going to talk about what history has to teach us about the moment that we're living through and where it comes up short. There's a good chance that you've heard the current anti-police violence protests compared to the unrest of the 1960s, 1990s, or other protest movements. And here at 538, we do like to look back at history to help guide our understanding of the present. After all, that's where a lot of the data we use comes from. But history won't tell us everything. This isn't the 1960s, and so we're gonna see what parallels we can draw and also try to make sense of what is different and maybe what that all says about where we're headed. And here with me to do that is 538 senior writer Perry Beacon Jr. Hi, Perry.
Hey, Galen.
And also joining us is Dean and Professor of History at the University of St. Thomas, Uhuru Williams. His research focuses on protest movements and the civil rights era. Uhuru, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start things off with you, Uhuru, and ask why protest movements coalesce when they do. So this time, the catalyst is the police killing of George Floyd, but there are clearly other factors at play. So does history have any hints about why a protest swells when it does?
Historians and sociologists generally debate this. So there are mass mobilizing movements and there are mass organizing movements. Mass organizing movements usually germinate from organizations that are looking at structural inequalities or other issues over time and really preparing to tackle those issues. So we could think about an organization like the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in the late 19th century or organization like the NAACP. So there's no triggering event, but a set of structures or issues that they coalesce around, and that becomes the agenda and blueprint for change for that organization. Mass mobilizing movements tend to erupt around or begin around incidents that drive people to want to make change. So the Montgomery bus boycott is a very good example of a mass mobilizing movement where you had this incident where Rosa Parks is refuses to give up her seat, and then people kind of coalesce around that issue. To be clear, often we confuse the two because mass organizing movements will work closely with mass mobilizing movements. So whereas George Floyd is a triggering event here in Minneapolis, you see the National Action Network coming to Minneapolis. You see Black Lives Matter coming to Minneapolis. And that's a good example of how the two work in concert to keep the pressure on to win the change that they want to see.
And how do the motivations and demands of protesters right now compare with past civil rights movements or police reform protests that we might look to as historical examples?
I think that's part of the frustration that you hear in the commentary of some of the people that are on the streets, is that there isn't a great deal of difference in what people are articulating as the core concerns. I like to call them the 6 degrees of segregation. So this is frustration not only about police brutality, which is the most intractable of those things, but lack of access to adequate housing, lack of access to places of public accommodation, unfair labor practices, voter disfranchisement. And these things work in concert. They're like tentacles of an octopus that squeeze the life out of communities of color, particularly the African-American community. The incident of police brutality tends to become the trigger where people connect the dots on those issues and say, this is simply a manifestation of what we're feeling in this community with regard to these other issues. And that's how we wind up with moments like we're in right now.
Perry, you wrote this week for the website 538.com about who is protesting. And I encourage everyone to go read the piece. It's really interesting. But what are your observations about who's out protesting in these movements?
So I will say that we don't have real data on the protesters yet. So what I was mainly observing here in Louisville, we also had a recent police shooting of a civilian, and we've had protests here as well. And so what I observed, at least sort of just as an observer, I remember the 2014 Ferguson protests. I remember the Black Lives Matter protests. I'm not saying there were no white faces. I just don't remember seeing a lot of them in prominent ways. Versus these protests in Louisville, and the pictures I've seen have had a lot of white people in the protest. In Louisville, there was a great photo in the paper of like six white people sort of standing between the police and the black protesters. That kind of jumped my story off. And you've also seen protests. I also had friends tell me there's protests in places like Des Moines where there aren't a ton of black people in Des Moines. So the protest has to involve white people by definition. So that's what I came away with. And the data suggests that a lot of white Democrats see these racial inequality issues, specifically about policing, policing in very similar ways to Black Americans. And so it tells me that who's there is probably white liberals, particularly younger white liberals and Democrats.
Why? I mean, is this a change? Is this different from the way that white Democrats have viewed issues of race in the past? And if it is different, what's changed?
So I'm going to defer to the historian a bit here, but just my brief points are, it's not like the civil rights movement. If you remember back, there were plenty of white people who went to the South who were involved there. So it's not, if you go to look at the March on Washington pictures or coverage, there are plenty of white people. I don't have a percentage for you, but there are plenty of white people who were there. So this is not totally unprecedented in the first place. That said, the polling suggests that since 2014, you've seen a large, like black people sort of already felt there was a lot of discrimination in the country against black people. What you've seen in the polling is a big surge in the number of white people who see A, broad systemic discrimination, and then B, specifically a lot of police discrimination against black people.
Yeah, Yehua, how are you processing the differences between historical protests and now in terms of the makeup of the protests?
Well, I enjoyed Perry's piece as well. I thought it was really fascinating to really unpack what the meaning is of what we're all seeing and in trying to suss out what the explanation for that is. Perry's absolutely right. White participation in the civil rights movement was not something that was foreign. In fact, when we think about Mississippi Summer, it was the murder of two white volunteers, Schwerner and Goodman, along with James Chaney, that resulted in the Freedom Summer that we're so familiar with, the death of Viola Luizzo and James Reeb, a white Unitarian minister and a white housewife from Detroit, that ultimately helped to galvanize Selma, in addition to the murder of a black man named Jimmie Lee Jackson. So the presence of whites in the black freedom struggle is not in and of itself foreign. What's unique here is the context. So when we saw the sit-ins at lunch counters, you're looking at maybe one or two whites who are participating. And some of the footage that we're seeing of today, you're seeing, in some cases, protests that are taking place in places where almost the majority of people there are white, depending on the community, or there's a large presence even in urban centers where you're seeing these protests take place of young whites. So, you know, this is an important moment, primarily because I think, as Perry is right to say, you're seeing a greater awareness. You know, I think it was called back in 2018, the Great Awakening. This moment where literally you were seeing people who are not part of the African-American community really beginning to not just appreciate but and talk about these issues, but be willing to go out and to protest, to take substantive action. And I think it's also coming in the context of a national Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, where people are getting that message that in order to be part of the change, you have to take action. And what we're seeing now, I believe, is people taking that action.
Yeah, I mean, is there more that we can say about why? Like, is it a direct line from the Black Lives Matter movement in 2014 to changing the minds of white Democrats? Is it about where they live? Is it a generational thing? Are more conservative Democrats just leaving the party altogether? How do we describe this awakening amongst white Democrats?
I think it is caught up, like, why did George Floyd become the moment? So my response would be three things. First of all, we've had this Black Lives Matter movement going for a long time. I would argue that maybe it's felt a little dormant from 2017 to 2019. I do think the sort of Trump story kind of, for lack of a better word, trumped Black Lives Matter a little bit for some period of time. It's not that police shootings haven't happened. In fact, there's about 1,000 police shootings of civilians overall. There's about 1,000 every year. That number has not changed. But I think the media sort of stopped covering it and there wasn't a big galvanizing event. And so I can't pinpoint exactly why this event, as this shooting. I do think the circumstances of what happened, the video itself, it appeared to be particularly egregious behavior of the police. So I think that sort of clarified it. It's on camera, so that always like makes things more viral. I think it may have helped. I mean, I don't want to say help, but I think it may have contributed that the Democratic primary was over. And so a lot of people I talked to during the Democratic primary, what they would tell me was, you guys in the media are obsessed with Pete versus Elizabeth versus Kamala versus Biden. We don't care. We just want to get Trump out. Can we get to the real event here? So I do think part of what's going on is that, as well as there was a pent up Democratic energy that I think was not particularly, I don't think Democrats in the main are excited about fighting each other over Medicare for all versus Medicare for most. I think they are really focused on unifying against Trump, and I think they do see police brutality and part of a sort of broader narrative about they view Trump, Democrats view Trump as racist, and I think they see him as part of the broader systemic problem. So I think these protests have an anti-Trump element, even if that's not spoken directly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Perry. I think that, you know, America is a nation of narratives and a nation of contrasts. And when those things line up in a way that helps to tell the story, you get these powerful moments. There were many people before Rosa Parks who were in exactly the same position she was in 1955 that didn't wind up kicking off what the Montgomery bus boycott and then the origins of what we associate with the traditional civil rights movement. George Floyd's coming at a time with President Trump in office, with 40 million Americans unemployed, with Americans fighting this pandemic, which is COVID-19, with many people for the first time experiencing firsthand what African-Americans have been articulating as the, or what Martin Luther King called, the smothering cage or airtight cage of poverty in America, and not being able to turn the TV off because it's not just impacting somebody over there, it's impacting me right here where I live. I would add to that, because I do believe it's generational, that you have this new generation of young people who've grown up on activism in a sense that they can look at an incident like Parkland. They can look at Trayvon Martin. I mean, their whole existence has been defined over the last 10 years of these mass mobilizing moments. And they've been coming pretty swiftly. So, you know, Perry talked about 1,000 police killings a year, but we could literally, from Trayvon Martin to today, talk about these, depending on how you want to define them, eruptions or disruptions or disturbances that have really captured the national attention. You then have the perfect storm of young people saying, you know, why hasn't anybody tackled this before? This is too much. If they're not going to act, we're going to act. You have almost that 60s moment where there's this perfect storm of the economic, social, political factors lining up in a certain way. The narrative kind of lending itself toward this type of intervention. And then I think Perry's absolutely right. You know, in the same way that the civil rights organizers talked about Eugene Bull Connor from Birmingham, the police chief or commissioner of public safety coming out of central casting, Trump almost comes out of central casting for what you don't want to be. If you're going to say that you're on the side of justice, and even if you don't empathize completely with those people who are out in the streets, it's hard to co-sign with someone who can't even demonstrate basic empathy. And so that has kind of created this, and Americans like a tragedy with a happy ending, this kind of cartoonishness about this moment that allows people to see it's this way or that way, even though it's their shades of gray, but it appears for most people black or white.
So one thing to add is I think the protests started off being the police are too mean to people, and it was mainly about the police being mean to black people. Then as the protests have went on, the police have been pretty aggressive with journalists and with white, with journalists who are both black and white and other races too. And also the police have been very aggressive with the protesters. So the police have almost proved the protesters' point in a certain way, the initial protesters. So I think that has kind of made it galvanize even more, as I think the protests are sort of building on top of each other as the police escalate, the protesters are getting more aggressive and getting madder. I think we're now, and I'm worried about the cycle a little bit. I do worry that maybe we're going to have like a incident where several people get killed because the police are angry, the protesters are angry. I'm worried about this, but I do think it's sort of reinforcing this sort of real deep tension right now.
Are there any historical comparisons here? I mean, what do we know about what happens within protest movements when either the police or protesters themselves start using violence as part of the equation? What happens next?
We probably have the best example of that from the report that was done by the Kerner Commission in 1967-68 in the aftermath of disturbances in 125 cities across the United States, the most violent of which took place in Newark, New Jersey, and Detroit, Michigan. And the task of the Kerner Commission was to answer three questions. What happened? Why did it happen? And how could we prevent it from happening again? And as I look back over the Kerner Commission report today, it's almost a textbook example of what we saw, not just in the 1960s, but what we saw in 1980 in Miami, what we saw in 1992 in the Rodney King riots, and what we're seeing, what we saw in 2014 in Ferguson, and what we're seeing on the streets of Minneapolis and many other cities today. You have typically a triggering event. People come out to protest. There's an initial spate of violence, which usually lasts a couple days, in which the protesters themselves begin to fragment between those who are saying peaceful protest and those who are saying by any means necessary. You then have typically a police response people kind of wane or get tired of the destruction and the calls for law and order. And then you have a restoration or reconciliation, which typically involves calls for law and order. So somehow the original impetus or focus of the protest is lost, and this simply becomes about getting those protesters off the street. So by any means necessary in the other direction. The danger of the moment we're in now, and I think this is what's unique about what Perry argued in the piece and what we're seeing on the streets, is that even as we've passed this initial phase of violence, what we haven't seen is this kind of massive backlash against the violence. What we're actually seeing is corporate entities putting out statements saying Black Lives Matter. You know, people from the right coming over and saying, you know, politics aside, this just isn't right. And that's a change, a significant change. Will it be enough to redefine the way that we've responded historically to these events? I'm not sure. That'll be manifest in the election in November, because certainly if we go back to the 1960s, there's no question that those riots in tainted Lyndon Johnson and partly explained his decision not to run in the ascendancy of Richard Nixon. So we do know this has a political impact. I think it might still be too early to tell in this moment. It really depends on what happens in the next few days.
Yeah, I think it's important what you said, that you have these elites across corporate, media, political, America coming out in support of these protests. One, is that fully new? Is that different from what we saw in, say, 2014 or 1992? And then two, is that going to affect public opinion? And I know, Perry, you've been looking into the polls, so maybe you can get into how public opinion is shaping up so far. But you who were maybe respond to that first. Is this wholly unique what we're seeing from, you know, the Bush's former Secretary of Defense, Mattis, for example, just coming from Ben and Jerry's, all these different places, support for the protests?
Very different than what we saw in the 1960s, and very different than what we saw in recent American history. So if we go back to 2014, you're not getting that chorus of voices that you are in this moment, who are coming out in, I think, very direct, clear and direct ways saying, you know, we saw this video. This was a case of murder, manslaughter at best, murder at worst. And these things are destructive to our Republican form of government. I mean, that is a distinctive change. The other thing I'd add to that, which I think is very interesting, because you mentioned the Bush's response, for example, is it also shows fissure within the Republican Party. And that's significant because, remember, that same fissure existed in the Democratic Party in 1968. Richard Nixon's appeal to the silent majority, the same language that Trump has used to try to talk about his base, the MAGAs, is important, because the question is, how does the middle feel? Those people who aren't out in the streets, those people who might be viewing this differently. At the same time, if you look at the numbers in these protests, particularly in urban centers, one has to, and again, we don't have the data quite yet to be able to determine how large this is, but just by the eyeball test, this is a pretty significant moment, and it may, in that sense, have a distinct impact on the elections.
So in terms of public opinion, what I think I'm seeing so far, there's not been a lot of polling on this, is that people think, even across parties, across races, everything, people think what happened to George Floyd was bad and shows problems with the police. You tend to see, even in surveys, Republicans generally are skeptical of systemic racism. But in terms of policing, you're close to half of Republicans, or 40%, who say in the police space, we think there is a broader problem in terms of how they treat Black people, not in other systemic racism, not like reparations style questions, but on that question alone. So that's one place. So George Floyd, there's a lot of unity. The poll suggests a plurality or majority of Americans so far support the aims of the protesters in this general, this broad movement about the Floyd killing and about the broader police issues. The polling also shows a majority of plurality are very concerned with, they think, if you phrase the question as in rioting, people do not like rioting, unsurprisingly, and that gets all Republicans and some Democrats to complain about what's happening too. So it depends on if this is defined as a protest movement about a undeserved killing, that is one thing. If it becomes symbolized by rioting, that's another. Final thing I would say is, so far the polls are where they are in terms of Biden v. Trump, which is that Biden has had this sort of slow, small but steady 5 to 6 point lead in the national polls. He leads in most of the key swing states, and that's still where we are. There's been no backlash to these protests that is hurting Biden so far, but like I said, very early, don't want to make any promises about the future.
We spent a little time talking about white Democrats and how they're getting involved in this protest movement. What can we say about black Democrats? I mean, I think maybe the media oftentimes kind of lump black voters all together because of the numbers at which they vote for Democrats. But are there any like socioeconomic or political divides amongst black voters on this issue or how they're engaging with the protests?
So my sense is not, I mean, if you look at the polls, what you see is pretty unanimous views that the polls suggest like 90% of black people think that we have a broader problem of police treating African-Americans unfairly. So that's a kind of a universal view. Similarly, that the Floyd killing was unjustified, kind of 90%. And you've seen this sort of across like Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods, not known to be people who want to jump involved in politics, have made statements saying this what happened with George Floyd is a problem that they want to, and the country should address it. So I do think often we sort of do lump in all black people together. In this case, I think there is a broad problem. One thing I'll be curious that I can't quite tell yet is at the protests themselves, I've seen some of them that have a fair amount of older people, but it does seem like the protests themselves may be mostly younger white people and younger black people, but I'm not sure because it depends on where you are and what you're seeing.
Yeah, also maybe important to point out that we're in the middle of a pandemic where older people are at higher risk.
Point.
I mean, I don't know how big of an effect that has, and it may be hard to discern. But I mean, I've seen pictures of older people hanging out of windows, ringing bells and giving support, but not necessarily out on the street.
I was just going to say it's interesting because when the Kerner Commission did its work, it said that the typical rioter was a young, quote unquote, Negro male, black male, high school dropout, lifelong resident of the city, so on and so forth. That's not who we're seeing in the streets now. I also think we talked about narratives earlier. President Obama gave a wonderful statement yesterday, kind of a first citizen moment, talking about the violence in Minneapolis and elsewhere, but then also kind of framing it historically. But he also made this appeal, which I think is a little bit problematic, about the importance of young people in social movements. And he says, well, Martin Luther King was a young man, Cesar Chavez was a young man, so on and so forth. The problem with that is that there is this presence of older people who are part of these protests, who are concerned. They've emerged in roles that, you know, typically we're not accustomed to seeing because the photographic moments tend to be of young people in front of fires with the Black Power salute. And then if you're out and you're kind of following these protests along, you see a rainbow of people who are actually involved, so on and so forth. I think that's problematic because the role of the media in this is essential. It was essential and critical during the civil rights movement. One of the reasons that you scholars credit Black Power for catching fire after 1966 is that you had veteran reporters who had once covered civil rights who went on to cover the Vietnam War because that was the big story. It left Cub reporters to cover the movement. They were looking for an angle because they wanted headlines. And it wasn't that Black Power wasn't significant, but in finding this conflict between Dr. King and Stokely Carmichael, they found the front pages, and that forever changed the way that we thought about the movement. So, you know, ultimately what I'm saying is that I agree with Perry. I think that there is a divide in terms of what young people believe about this moment, how they've been socialized, how they're responding to it, what they see as legitimate aims of protest, because, you know, typically what we're not seeing are demands. So this is part of the frustration on the part of people like Jacob Fry here in Minneapolis, the mayor, Melvin Carter in St. Paul. You know, what are the demands of the protesters? And the protesters say, we have no demands. We're going to be here until, you know, we believe that the structural inequalities are gone. You didn't see that typically in the civil rights movement, at least in terms of what the NAACP, the Urban League, Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference were able to articulate. Those were movements with clear leadership. This is a moment where you have Black Lives Matter kind of embracing the leaderless model. But when you do that, it's largely decentralized and it's harder for people to discern who the typical protester is, what the demands are, what will get people off the streets. And once the violence comes in, those questions become critical because even if you've got goodwill, eventually people are going to want to return to normality, to normalcy.
Okay, I have a ton of questions about what you just said, ranging from the organizational structure to press coverage. Maybe let's start with organizational structure and specific demands. What does that mean? Do past protest movements suggest that you need specific demands in order to be successful? Because I do see Democratic and even some Republican politicians scrambling to try to move policy, even though that they haven't necessarily been given specific demands. So what does that mean? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing for these protesters' aims?
Robert Penn Warren wrote a great book in 1963, the title of which I love, and it was entitled Who Speaks for the Negro? And that, or 1965, that encapsulates exactly the problem here, is that on that old model, what people wanted to know is, who's the black leader and what do black people want? And then we'll respond to that list of demands. And then we expect you to make the violence go away. And that was our model of leadership and engagement for a long time. So under Martin Luther King until his assassination, Jesse Jackson seemed to pick up that mantle for a long time. Then it was Al Sharpton and the National Action Network. There was a discernible change in 2014 with the murder of Michael Brown, because you had young protesters show up at the March on Millions in D.C. and actually demand the mic from Al Sharpton and say, no, this is our uprising. This is our movement. This is our moment. This is our rebellion. We want to speak. And they were not content with having outside organizations, as they saw it, or older leaders come in and define what the legitimate aims of that movement were. They wanted that level of control. I understand that, but it's a little bit problematic for those of us of a different age, and certainly for politicians who are operating on a model. I've seen Melvin Carter here, you know, struggle with this. I'm, you know, St. Paul's first African-American mayor. You know, I'm obviously sympathetic to these things, and I've had a progressive agenda. Just tell me what it is that you need beyond, you know, additional charges for these officers. And the reason I mention that is, remember, in Ferguson, those protesters stayed on the streets. And they said they were going to stay there until the structural issues that they saw as important were addressed. So in a lot of ways, I think that's a big difference. At the end of the day, I think there are a lot of Americans who still would feel comfortable with a Robert Penn Warren, who speaks for black people and what do they want model, so they can just make this go away, as opposed to a new generation that's comfortable being uncomfortable and is willing to kind of be in that space where they say, this transcends, you know, just police reform. We want something much deeper, and we're willing to tackle, you know, we're not going to just limit this to the police, because we saw here in Minneapolis the other day, the protesters now are, or the demonstrators have moved on to the media and are moving on to other targets where they're saying, you're part of the problem. You're part of these layers of oppression that we see that are helping to contribute to these issues.
Can I ask two questions? I guess, first of all, historically, has a leaderless movement been effective? And the second question is, are we sure this is a leaderless movement, or is, like, Brittany Packnett, something like that, the unofficial president of Black Lives Matter?
It's such a great question, Barry, because, I, you know, being in the thick of it, it's really hard to tell. The way I look at it is that there have been leaderless movements, but there have been people who have emerged who have become endorsed spokespersons. And those are the people that the quote unquote power structure look to kind of control or seek to control those moments. A good example is, you know, Martin Luther King kind of ran afoul of some of the young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Congress for Racial Equality when he didn't want to go on freedom rides, because he thought that, you know, wasn't going to, you know, in that moment, it didn't seem to be a practical solution. And he was actually, you know, you had the Kennedy administration kind of imploring King on various occasions not to do certain things, because they recognized, you know, as John Kennedy would appeal to him, you know, I didn't win with the majority of the popular vote, and I'm willing to push this agenda, but I need your help in keeping the streets calm to keep this on the front, you know, in front of people's, you know, minds and at the top of my agenda. Today, I think that you do have leaders, and you mentioned Black Lives Matter, it's a good example. The extent to which they'd be willing to horse trade in that way is what's at question. The extent to which you can find, you know, you could isolate, you know, somebody within Black Lives Matter and say, I've spoken to the president of Black Lives Matter, and they say you all should go home because we're going to desegregate lunch counters, you know, or there's a report now, the Minnesota Commission of Human Rights on police practices, everybody go home. That moment is over in terms of protest in this country.
Perry, when it comes to the political response, you spend a lot of time tracking what's going on Capitol Hill, and you're very good at being realistic about what kind of legislation is being worked on, what has a chance of passing. You know, how do you see the political will on Capitol Hill to address some of these concerns?
So on Capitol Hill and in Washington, I think you're going to have a lot of, like, hearings, and I think Trump has a commission, lots of, like, sound and fury signifying nothing. That's my guess in Washington. But this is not a Washington problem, because basically you have Democratic mayors and Democratic city councils having Democratic people who voted for them say, fix this. So I do think you're going to see policing changes at the local level. I don't know what they're going to be yet, but like my guess is you're going to see a lot of fights over like the police have all this military equipment. We talked about this in 2014. Do the police need to have so much of that military equipment? I think you're going to see the more liberal city councilman, sort of city council person sort of push that and say they shouldn't. And then we'll see where the mayors and the city councils who are more moderate Democrats say. I think you'll see different changes in how, you know, use of force policies. I do think you'll have police chiefs fired. The Louisville one already got fired. So I do think you will see changes at the local level and maybe the state level in blue states particularly. So I think there is going to be a list of changes. And we had a piece earlier this week showing in the post-Ferguson era, we've actually had a lot, we haven't stopped police shootings, police killings, but we actually have had a lot of policy changes. We've had body cameras in more places. I think a lot of reforms are going to happen this period. So I'm not sort of fatalistic about what's going to happen. But I do think it's going to be a weird process where I don't think the protesters are going to say, here's our list of demands. And I would say here in Louisville, at least, the protesters are saying, we want you to defund the police. I promise you that will not happen. And I don't think older Black folks are for that either. I haven't seen a poll, but I don't have to guess. I'm pretty sure they're not for that. And so what I think you're going to see, I think what they're doing is sort of like, here is an extreme demand over here, and then we're going to let the political process work out where if the extreme position is defund the police, the moderate position can become, we're going to really have an aggressive change in police practices. That's what I think is going on. The protesters are almost being intentionally extreme, is my impression.
You said that in many cases, it's Democratic constituents putting pressure on Democratic politicians. Is this something that ultimately ends up dividing urban Democrats, meaning both kind of the white elites who have moved into cities over the past decades and these protesters?
So my sense is it isn't, because if we were talking about some kind of like aggressive school integration plan, I would say, oh dear, Joe Biden should start thinking about his answer and he should be concerned. But I don't think in terms of like policing that there's a huge divide between like let's be put it bluntly, white liberals in a lot of these cities are not worried about the police doing much to them unless they go to a protest. So I think it's not like you're not taking anything away from them. You're asking them to sort of join a racial cause that for them is often a little bit symbolic. I don't want to be rude about that, but I think it's a little bit symbolic. It's easy for them to be for it, I think. So I don't see that kind of divide happening. I do think if we get into a fight over like the budget of the police department, then I don't think it's a presidential issue, but I think most mayors, Democrat or Republican, like to have a big police budget because they like to, you know, bring businesses to town and assure businesses there won't be any, if you have a convention here, there won't be any crime. So I think that will be a fight between sort of Democrats in executive jobs and like activists, but I don't think it'll be a sort of national political divide.
Yeah. You mentioned the other thing that you mentioned when I said before I had a ton of questions that I wanted to follow up with. You mentioned how the press is covering these protests, and you said that historically, we're a nation that's in many ways defined by contrasts and narratives. And I really appreciated that, you know, we are part of the narrative building, of course, here in the media on this podcast. So we'll acknowledge that. But looking more broadly, we're not the most traditional media company, I guess, as a bunch of podcasters. Looking more broadly, how is the press covering these protests in comparison to past protests?
Well, you know, first, let me say that I think it's also been critical to have independent journalism. And even within protest movements, one of the first things that the Black Panther Party did was start a newspaper, because they recognized that they had to have a counter narrative to the narrative that was in the press about what the issues were. First of all, just basic coverage of what was happening in communities, but then also a counter narrative to the way that they were portrayed in the press. So I think that that's important. In terms of the coverage to date, I would say that what's interesting is that this has also played out in kind of a reframing of the media that we've watched over the last 30 years, where there's a de-emphasis on what I grew up with, which was, you know, Ted Koppel or some other older heterosexual white male coming on, being the voice of reason to tell me that everything was fine in the world and kind of give me the narrative for the day about, you know, what, where the world was and where we were going forward. And I don't say that to be divisive. I just say that in a lot of ways, that's what the norm was. Today, people are free to retreat to their respective corners and get whatever bent on the news that they want. In journalism as we knew it, that is somebody coming on offering a narrative of where we are, has been replaced by, you know, panels, talking heads, you know, talking at the camera, having a particular point of view. And while that's not foreign in American history, in fact, we can see that strain of journalism from the founding. Part of the challenge then is, where do you get credible information about what things look like on the streets of St. Paul, Minnesota at 1 o'clock in the morning, if you then can't trust that the information that's being fed in? And that becomes less of an issue then, how do you find out about Breonna Taylor? How is that not national news if the press, you know, the third estate isn't aggressively pursuing those stories? And remember, the founders talked about an informed electorate. And part of the challenge will be, even in the aftermath of the civil unrest that we're watching play out in these cities, is how informed people are about this not just being about George Floyd. Yes, that's true. But a range of other issues. And I'll give you one good example of this: health disparities. We just found out through Pioneer Press here that George Floyd tested positive for COVID-19. His death now becomes symbolic not only of police brutality, but health disparity, because this was the argument being made by Cuomo and others about the need for testing and how communities of color were disproportionately impacted. Now, had he manifested any symptoms? No. They're saying at this point, we don't know, because now, unfortunately, he's passed on or killed, murdered. But the reality is, this is part and parcel of, you know, passing a $20 bill, if in fact he was guilty of that, leads to him being executed by the police. But then we find out a range of other issues tied to that killing that point to the other disparities which define the experience of people of color in this country, African Americans in this country.
So the one thing with the media, I would say, Galen, is that I remember in 2014, I worked at NBC News, and our editors and managers were just confused. Who are these people? I don't understand why their slogan is Black Lives Matter. Like, where are they coming from? So I think there is, like, just a broader understanding of what happens. And that probably helps the movement a little bit, is that we're not introducing a new group of people in a new narrative, but we have sort of familiar narratives. And I feel like that helps with the politicians, like Barack Obama, you know, black politician, well-schooled in racial issues, was also sort of confused by what was going on, versus yesterday, he had an event, he had BLM associated speakers. He sort of knows. I think people now have a formula about what to do and how to cover this and how to think about it. And you're seeing, like, in the sort of mainstream media, I'd say there's a tension between, is this protest and are these riots? And mostly coverage of them is like sort of an, I would say, in a positive frame of protests, with some focus on riots. You have the Fox News focus, which is very much on riots. So it's kind of playing out as in a lot of stories are. And then on Twitter and social media, I think you would argue it's pretty much playing as in protest, and the riots thing is a dumb thing to say. I think you're seeing kind of where we see a lot of stories, where social media is left, Fox is right, and the media, the mainstream media, is trying to figure out where it stands, where the story is, and to be present and present as balanced as possible.
And to your point, Perry, because I love that point about Obama, those narratives are important. So Melvin Carter ran a very successful campaign here using the symbolism and the language of the civil rights movement. So what happens when protests, riots erupt in your city, and then that narrative fails you in addressing a new generation who doesn't have that backstory, doesn't kind of buy into that, you know, that larger meta narrative to really understand their moment? And you know, I listened to the mayor on one of the morning programs the other day, and he was saying, you know, people have to get out and register to vote, because voting, you know, getting elected officials is the key to combating this problem. And then I talked to young people in the streets that say, we did vote. We have an African-American right. police chief in Minneapolis right. and a black mayor in St. Paul, and we don't feel anything has changed. I think that's both unfair to them, because there have been some really progressive things that they've done here on the ground. But the reality is, the narrative is nothing's changed. And that's damning to those people that occupy those positions. Because I will also say this, it was, we all know this, unprecedented to have the immediate firing of those four officers involved in that incident. So the incremental change gets lost in the kind of broader way in which movement people want to shape the narrative, the press seeks to shape the narrative. And to your point, Perry, about what happened at the editorial desk when you were there, I mean, part of the challenge even in the 60s was whoever's out covering that is going to decide what the bent is. You know, they made Stokely Carmichael the cartoonish, evil, child of Malcolm X and turned Black Power into this thing that it both was and wasn't. And so part of the challenge that we have in this moment is that it's great to have editors who kind of get it and understand it. But then we're also framing this in terms of who we bring in to talk about it through the lens of those like myself who have a distinctively, you know, I share the meta narrative with Barack Obama. So I tend to see the movement in that same lens, in that same light. I love incremental change. You know, I like peaceful, nonviolent protest. I like to quote the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. But then at the same time, you know, can understand where this generation of young people is because I haven't experienced the trauma they've experienced in the same way.
Yeah, that's really interesting, that divide. I was in South Carolina before the primary speaking with the pastor of a Black Baptist church, and he was like, honestly, all of these white people running for president need to stop coming to my church and quoting Martin Luther King. And like, that doesn't really seem like something you would have heard during a 2008 Democratic primary or a 2004 Democratic primary, right? I mean, this is what you're saying, but just talking about the civil rights movement doesn't have the same meaning for younger people.
Absolutely.
You know, this conversation could go on forever, and I still have many more questions I want to ask. So maybe we've established the ways in which this moment is different, and we're going to continue charting the ways in which it's different as time goes on, and I hope you'll come back and we'll continue talking about this. Historically, how do these moments come to an end?
I would say that in this moment, there are so many X factors because with COVID-19, with so many people out of work, with social media, there's actually capacity now for people to be out for a longer term here and to try to keep pressure on in that way. So I'm a little reluctant to be predictive, except to say that in the past, the way these traditionally have ended is one of two ways. Either there is a set of demands that are made and those demands are met and the protesters yield the street and the cleanup begins and it's back to the way things were before. Or there's a commissioning of some report a la Ferguson, and then the powers that be feel that they've satiated or met that need and then back to the status quo. And then there's the other side of this, which is there's a political backlash. And we saw this in 68. One could argue you saw shades of this in 1980 and in 1992, where what it does is either build up support for regime change or affirm the sitting regime. And if that regime's modus operandi, like President Trump's, is law and order, if the violence continues, if the disorder continues, it'll be very easy for him to campaign on a platform of, you know, we've got to restore order. And that may resonate with people in this moment.
And Perry, you already mentioned that you've been looking at the public opinion polling, but is there any sense that this is leading to a backlash at this point or no?
Not yet. I mean, one thing, and I know the professor knows this too, is I think history is important and it's worth considering. But that said, the demographics of the country are so much different now. And I mean by that, way more Latinos, way more Asians, and the Democrats who are the white people in the Democratic Party are like very liberal on racial issues. So I do think the amount of the potential of the backlash, I'm not like, again, Joe Biden has to win Wisconsin. Wisconsin is not full of like, you know, people who are yelling Black Lives Matter and reparations for everybody. So I don't want to overstate that either, but I do think the way this is 68, 72, 80, just the population is so different. I know, like, Hillary Clinton was accused of, like, speaking too much about racial issues and that kind of thing. She came very close to winning, much closer than a lot of Democrats did, considering how she talked. Like, Joe Biden is running, I would argue, sort of a more moderate campaign on these kinds of issues. But I still think where the country is so different in terms of how it sees itself in terms of racial issues, that I think some of the history may be limiting and telling us a lot about where we are today.
All right. Well, I think we're going to leave things there. And I'll just acknowledge that, like, I, reading the articles that you've written, Perry, and the research that you've done, Yuhuru, I still have a lot of questions that I didn't get to, but we're going on an hour and we'll have time to hopefully discuss them in the future. So I'll leave things there. Thank you so much for joining us today, Yuhuru.
Thank you for having me. It was a blast.
And great piece, Perry.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yehuru Williams is Dean and Professor of History at the University of St. Thomas. And thanks to you, Perry. And I'll mention that the piece that we were discussing earlier, if folks want to look for it on the website, is called How Lots of White Democrats Ended Up at the Protest. So thanks, Perry.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.